On this episode of the London Lyceum, we talk with Dr. Brendan Case about the nature of angels, particularly in the medieval period. So we cover topics like just what are the standard views of angels during this period? Is there one view that's more dominant than others? Who are the key proponents of what is called universal hylomorphism, and what are the benefits of affirming such a view? What are the potential costs? And what is really the relevance of thinking about the metaphysical status of angels for the regular everyday churchman? And much, much more. As always, if you have thoughts about the episode or ideas or requests for the show in general, hit us up, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or check us out at our website, thelondonlyceum.com. Now, for the only analytic, Baptist, and confessional podcast on the planet, we think this one's going to get you thinking. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to another episode of the London Lyceum. I'm one of your hosts, Jordan Stefaniak.
And I'm your other host, Brandon Askew.
And today we're bringing back our friend, Dr. Brendan Case, to talk about angels and particularly universal hylomorphism. I think when it comes to this topic about just the constitution of angels, I would imagine most people have a vague sense of what Brendan calls, I guess, spiritual immaterialism, which I guess at bottom is a Thomistic account of angels to some degree, where they don't have any matter whatsoever. And I don't know how many people, I think there's lots of people, when you actually start thinking about angels and you start asking questions, people probably realize, wow, I have no idea what to think about that. But there is, to some degree, I think, a default to not universal hylomorphism. So we're going to talk about what is universal hylomorphism and all these different metaphysical options on angels. I think it's going to be really fun. But before we do that, Brendan, for those who haven't listened to your previous episode on your book, The Accountable Animal, give us a little bit of an introduction or background on you. And then what is it that made you start thinking about the topic of the metaphysics of angels?
Wonderful to be with you guys again. Thanks, Jordan and Brandon. As you said, I'm Brendan Case. I'm the Associate Director for Research of a little outfit called the Human Flourishing Program at Harvard University. And our program aims to study and promote human flourishing and to develop systematic approaches to the synthesis of knowledge across disciplines, and in particular across the social sciences and the humanities. So help think about what is it that makes human beings flourish and how can we promote that, you know, in more effective ways. Obviously, none of that has much to do with the angels. I'm trying to think back exactly to how, you know, my life has changed so much in the last 2 years. It's very interesting. I mean, the angel stuff is a kind of barometer, I suppose, for that. But so I did my doctorate in theology at Duke Divinity School. I was there for a long time, both as a master's and doctoral student. And I wrote my dissertation. I ended up writing it on the doctrine of creation in the thought of a medieval theologian named Bonaventure, St. Bonaventure of Bagna Reggio, and an Enlightenment philosopher named George Berkeley. And they have some really interesting sort of convergences and despite very different idioms and milieus and kind of thought worlds, some really striking similarities in the way they think about what it means to say that God creates the world. And they both think of creation as a kind of language, essentially, that God speaks. And so that's sort of the theme of the main idea of the book, really, is of the dissertation, I should say, which has not been published anywhere except in bits, you know, in articles, is creation as divine language. And one key idea for Bonaventure and his understanding of creation as a kind of divine language is that the medium in which the words that creatures are uttered for Bonaventure is what he calls matter. So it's basic for Bonaventure to being a creature, to being not God, that you have this sort of metaphysical part that he calls matter. And so I became interested in it because in the idea of the angels in particular, because it's very important for Bonaventure that angels be hylomorphic, angels be material. It's constitutive of their, it's sort of baked into their creaturehood, that they, and so I ended up having a chapter on, on, on the angels as a kind of limit case, you know, effectively for thinking about creaturehood, you know. And so, you know, I mean, it might be useful. I mean, maybe this might be your next question, I suppose. But I do think it's very important as we sort of get into this discussion, just to get clear on some of the terms, you know. So you've mentioned hylomorphism, right, which is not, you know, really English, right? I mean, so in ordinary language, you know, we tend to use the word matter as a kind of placeholder for just stuff, you know, particularly stuff that takes up space effectively, you know, anything that physics talks about, you know, is material. This has become complicated in interesting ways, even within physics, though, frankly. I mean, now, you know, there are a number of elementary particles physicists have identified which are massless. Electrons are an example, you know. So what does that mean exactly to say, are they material or are they not? Or, you know, I mean, so the term is sort of in ordinary usage, I think, is very fuzzy. And you need to kind of bracket that usage. It's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about stuff. We're not talking about things that the usage that becomes standard following Aquinas does connect matter with being body, with being embodied. But even there, it's kind of complicated in ways that I might get into a bit later. The term hylomorphism is a neologism. I don't know when it was coined, but probably 19th century would be my guess, to describe this theory developed first by Plato and the Timaeus, but sort of formalized in a more robust way by Aristotle in his books, The Physics and then The Metaphysics, for a way, it's a theory about change, change over time, continuity and change, right? So there are two terms in the theory, form and matter, hyle and morphe in Greek. And the idea is that anything that changes is a composite of these two parts, right? So there is a and you might think of it just in a general way. It's sort of useful, I guess, to think of it as the difference in ordinary language between asking what and asking, and between what and that, you know. So or which, what and which, you know. So if you have two dogs. And this is actually, so I mean, I'll say the theory does more work than just explaining continuity and change, as we'll see now. It also has to do with what it is that makes tokens of a given type tokens of that type, you know. So it has sort of higher order work to do as well. But so if you have two dogs, say, just to take a simple example, or two trees, you know, you can ask, what is it about them that makes them both trees? And that question is asking about form. It's asking about the sort of intelligible structure that's embedded in those objects that makes them tree-ish, you know, or dog-ish. But there's also something about them, obviously, that makes one that dog and the other this dog, you know. That question is a question about matter. There's some distinct stuff that the, whatever that intelligible structure that makes a dog or a tree is embedded in. It comes to, it organizes some stuff, you know, carbon atoms, you might say, or whatever. They get organized in a tree-like way, and that makes them a tree. And the reason it's important for thinking about change, though, is that, So particular substances are always coming and going in the world, right? The world is a sort of, if you just look around, you know, everything below the moon, certainly, this is sort of the standard ancient view, is just in constant flux, you know? The same group of atoms, say, which, you know, 100 years ago was a tree, they're now all scattered. They've gone somewhere else, you know. Some of them are me, some of them are you, you know, some of them are in the ground. And there are new things now in their place. There's grass, maybe, as we just indicated, there are persons, you know. And so, you know, you ask the question, what is it that underlies, is there anything that provides stability and continuity for the world amid this flux? Because what comes and goes are forms, you know. tree form was here, it goes away when the tree is destroyed. When a person dies, the form, both of humanity and the specific form that made me, me, you know, say when I die, leaves the world. It's not there anymore, you know? And so what does the form come to? And what does it leave? And the answer in this theory, the theory of hylomorphism, is matter. So form and matter is what explains how things, anything that can change on Aristotle's view has matter. And so he says, Aristotle makes it quite clear in the Metaphysics that the intelligible movers, the basically gods, is his version of the Greek pantheon, which move the various planetary bodies in their courses all the way up to God with a capital G, the prime mover, you know, the unmoved mover. None of them have any matter because they don't change. They just are eternally, you know. So that's the framework, you know, within which we're thinking about hylomorphism. It's not a question about like stuff. Are angels, you know, could you put them in a box or whatever? I mean, it's a question about what are the conditions under which it's possible for change.
Yeah. So maybe let's set the table. In your paper, you have Aquinas in one corner and Bonaventure in the other corner, and Aquinas relies on this, what you refer to as the Boethian distinction, to account for change in angels. And then Bonaventure comes along and he says, basically,
yeah,
I think he agrees with that distinction, but he says it's not enough. So walk us through these two different views. So after you sketch out Aquinas' view, tell us how Bonaventure responds to that.
And so essentially what happens in the 13th century is the works of Aristotle, all of these scientific works of Aristotle, are reintroduced to Europe after being absent for centuries, you know? And Christians had obviously been thinking about the angels for a long time, but there'd never been, you know, really a very robust discussion of this particular question. You know, what is the metaphysical constitution of an angel? But it was provoked; it was made kind of acute by these Aristotelian texts, which describe, you know, beings which sound a lot like angels. You know, frankly, I mean, the intelligences, you know, are Christians often Christian theologians often refer to them as angels. So what to say about them? You know, if Aristotle's a great authority for these guys on matters of natural philosophy, you know, if Aristotle thinks that they're immaterial, maybe we should just say, so Aquinas has this view, which is, plausible. There's an intuition here that, anything that's material can't think. Okay, this is the basic concern, right? This is his, I call it his panzer. You know, this is sort of the knockdown argument he thinks just makes it impossible to say that angels could be immaterial, because everyone agrees that angels are intellectual beings, of a more, and whatever that means exactly, they're more intellectual than we are. You know, because for one thing, broad agreement by the 13th century that they don't have bodies like we do, so they don't have eyes. We get all of our, we can't know anything, you know, without some inputs. We need inputs from the world, you know. And angels don't seem, if they don't have bodies, they don't rely on them in quite that, on inputs in quite the same way. So they're intellectual on an even higher level than we are, you know. And the problem with matter, in Aquinas' view, is that matter, when it receives a form, it restricts it. This is the thought. So when the form of, let's just stay with our example, dog nature, comes to comes to matter, what that matter does is it restricts it to being a particular dog, this dog here now, you know, and so too for human nature, right? You can't shake hands with humanity. You can only shake hands with Socrates or with Brendan or with, right? And so, and that's because matter restricts. Then if there's matter in our intellects, then, anytime we attempted to know something, all we would be able to know were particulars, because it would reparticularize. That's the thought. That's the basic intuition, is that the intellect has to be free from matter. And then there's discussion in Aristotle's book on the soul, which is sort of along these lines, you know? But there's a problem here, still, as you've indicated, because if angels aren't composite in any way, if they're not put together out of parts, then they'd just be God. They'd be simple, truly metaphysically simple. And there's a lovely set of proofs, essentially, in the early questions of Aquinas' Summa Theologiae, his big masterwork, you know, which show essentially that true simplicity, meaning having no parts at all, is a property of God and God alone. And anything that's not God has to be composite, has to be put together in some way out of what Aristotle calls potency and act, which is you know, again, another kind of intuitive distinction, which I suppose we maybe don't need to spend all that much time unpacking. But I mean, potency and act, just to put it very simple, is I'm sitting right now. I'm in potency to standing, right? I could stand, you know. I'm not currently standing, this is in the background. Everybody takes this for granted. Angels have to be put together somehow. They have to be composed. So what are they composed of if not form and matter? Well, another possibility sort of lurking in the philosophical and theological tradition comes from Boethius, who's this late ancient commentator and translator of Aristotle. He translated a lot of Aristotle's logical works. And he makes a distinction between what a thing is and that by which it is. Quod est in Latin, quod est and quo est, right? And this is a distinction which gets a lot of mileage in medieval discussions. Everybody has their own definition, essentially, of the two terms. Everyone understands it in slightly different ways. Broadly speaking, they tend to map on to the difference between essence and existence. Just for our purposes, I think this is the simplest way of thinking about it. So there's a great discussion of this, classic discussion of this in Aquinas's early work. Where he says, think about a phoenix. Okay, so you can get I'm right now probably imagining a phoenix, right? So we know broadly speaking what a phoenix is. You know, it's a bird which every so often bursts into flames and then is reborn from its own ashes. You know, and you can know, or Pegasus, say, you know, Pegasus flying horse. You can know in some suitably indeterminate sense what a thing is without knowing whether it is, right? So it's logically possible that there, let's just say, that there are phoenixes. It's logically possible that there are flying horses, you know. As a matter of fact, contingently, there happen not to be, you know. And that's the difference between essence and existence. Knowing what a thing is doesn't tell you whether it is. And so the two are put together in a sense. And creation, one way of thinking about what the act of creation is, it's God's putting essences together with existence. You know, God actualizes some set of essences. Typically the thought is some subset of possible essence, of possible existence, you know, so he doesn't make Pegasus even though he could have, you know, he doesn't make Mr. Tumnus even though he could have, right? I mean, so those are, you know, so one way of thinking about literature is that it gives you a window onto possible worlds, you know, right? These are worlds that could have, it could exist, but don't, in fact, you know, so Aquinas thinks that the fact that angels also are put together out of essence and existence is sufficient. It gives you enough leverage to explain everything that needs explaining, essentially. So angels are, they're contingent in just the way that you or I are, right? Because every angel is a distinct essence, which has to be paired with an act of being in order to exist. And that makes them finite. But he wants to make a further claim, and this is where I want to get off the train. I'm with him so far, actually. I mean, I think Bonaventure's with him so far too. But he makes a further claim, which is that distinction also suffices to explain how angels can change once they exist, right? And the explanations that he and his fellow travelers, so Albert, his teacher, Albert the Great, also has a version of these same set of arguments against universal hylomorphism along the same lines, although he has a slightly different understanding of the quotas quoas distinction. They tend to appeal to sort of deeply implausible analogies, I think. So like Aquinas says at one point, just in the way that, a translucent medium like air sort of both receives and transmits color, you can maybe imagine that if there were like a self-subsistent, I think he actually says a subsisting quality of translucence, diaphanetas is what he says in Latin, it would sort of be like an angel, and would be capable of like acting and receiving actions, even though it's purely simple. And the simplest response to this is that the analogy is nonsense. The analogy only works because translucent media are actually material, and it begs all the important questions. And they tend, all of the analogies tend to be like this, frankly. There's a basic failure within the Thomist position to reckon with the fact that the Boethian distinction, as I call it, just does not explain how anything can change. It explains how angels could exist. An angel, a spiritually immaterial or Thomistic angel, would just exist and would be frozen, just like Aristotle thought the intelligences were. They would just be a subsistent act of thinking. But angels are clearly not like that. They have to change at least once. Everybody agrees. Some angels fell, right? So if you can't, and it seems as though, it certainly seems as though the event, say, of Gabriel speaking to Zechariah is a different event for Gabriel than the event of his speaking to Mary, in the Gospel of Luke, say, So again, you need some account of how it is that angels undergo changes of intellect and will. The ordinary framework for explaining those kinds of changes, if you're working within the kind of tradition of classical metaphysics, let's just call it, that sort of runs from Plato through Aristotle, and that's sort of the common coin of thinkers in this period. And I don't assume, by the way, that you have to do that. You can do Calvin and Barth go their own way, in this. So this is Bonaventure's basic point. He says this over and over again, and you can tell he's very exasperated, frankly, in various texts where he sort of keeps coming back to this and says, look, we're not saying, there's actually a text where he says, it's in his Senses commentary. He's talking about the human soul at this point, the soul of Adam, and whether our souls are composed of form and matter. He thinks they are too. But he says in that text that, we're not saying that the composition out of quod est and quo est isn't real. We're just saying it doesn't suffice for explaining how we undergo changes of intellect and will. And so that's the basic. I think that the universal hylomorphist position is defensible. I think it ought to be, a serious contender in any discussions about the nature of angels. But what I really want to emphasize, the real point of this paper in a way, is just that people should just give up on the Thomistic approach, because it just doesn't work. It fails on its own terms. It's not a candidate, for the best angelology, because it's not a consistent angelology. It doesn't explain really even the most minimal sort of points of data about the angels, like how they could fall. You need some forms. The basic way of putting this, and there's a kind of another slogan which gets quoted a lot by people like Bonaventure, is that forms are not subjects. So forms are predicated of things, right? So a form, just to take a simple example, a quality like the color of my hair at the moment is brown, right? Brown is a quality in the Aristotelian terms. It's an accident of my hair. It's a form, an accidental form, which contingently, is a property of my hair. In a decade or whatever, 15 years, my hair will be gray. You know, what changes is the form, but you don't predicate properties of forms. You wouldn't say that, you know, that my brownness is hair, right? You see what I'm saying? I mean, so if angels are forms, they can't take predicates. If angels are universals, you know, it's a confusion. It's a sort of fundamental confusion within the framework of the Aristotelian metaphysical tradition to think that angels could be subsisting forms and also be the subject of change. Forms come and go, but forms themselves are not. You need form to come together with matter to form a substance in order to have a subject of change. You know, so that's the basic thought.
Yeah, I think of Thomas and his approach, and it, you're mentioning how it's confusing. Well, yeah, it's confusing to me too.
Bottom up is confusing as well. I mean, don't get me wrong; it's very, you know. We're ill-equipped to think about these things, I think. So
yeah. So I guess maybe I'm wondering, it's not necessarily that angels have to be made up of form and then actual physical stuff that I can touch, that I can see. Mm-hmm. Right. But they do have to have matter in this other type of sense. So what sense this is, I'm not totally sure. Maybe this is where you get the, you know, how many angels can dance on the head of a pin question from.
Totally. Yeah, no, it's right. It's great. It's great. It's, and you know, the funny thing is that actual question is, I mean, I think it's another like 19th century, you know, coinage or whatever. I can't remember who's mocking, you know, the discipline of angelology, but it actually bridges from a very serious question, which is an interesting question which is sort of slightly to one side of this issue, but which is about angelic modes of presence, you know, are angels present distensively? There's a distinction between distensive and definitive presence, or presence by intention. And everybody in this period basically agrees that angels are not present distensively, as you, Jordan, just indicated. They don't take up space, you know. So they have to be present some other way. And it means essentially that as many angels as want could be. How many angels could dance on the head of a pin? Well, as many as wanted to, because they don't take up space, you know.
So no matter what position you take, whether it's Bonaventure or whether it's Thomas, you can answer that question the same way, it seems.
Yeah, the question about local presence, like, right. Yeah, sure, certainly, yeah. Yeah, they both agree, and this is an interesting point, which we haven't discussed yet, I guess, but they both agree that angels don't have bodies of any kind. And it's worth noting that there's another stream of Christian thinking about this, which doesn't accept that, you know, which attributes, you find this even in Augustine. Augustine entertains the idea that angels have ethereal bodies, is what he calls them, spiritual bodies, effectively, sort of like, you know, on analogy with resurrection bodies, I guess. This position, they all consider it. Bonaventure has a discussion of it in his Sentences commentary and says, you know, he recognizes the fathers, you know, entertain this position, but it's now become clear, he says, essentially to the mind of the church, that this is not tenable. And, you know, this is a, you know, again, like I said before, it's a somewhat secondary issue to me, you know, whether spiritual bodies are a viable candidate, you know, for angelology alongside, say, universal hylomorphism, principally because, I mean, my real interest, you know, like I said before, is just getting people to stop trying to make the Thomistic approach work, you know. So if we could just regroup, you know, we could discuss the spiritual bodies question. That raises, in a way, that simplifies things, you know, in some ways, because you can say, well, you know, we don't really know what they are, but at least they're sort of like our bodies, you know. I mean, they're thinner maybe or whatever, or maybe we're thinner and they're, you know, they're the real stuff. Interestingly, the basic logic for Bonaventure and Aquinas for rejecting that view, the spiritual bodies view, it's a modal argument that they offer. I mean, which I mean, it's an argument from thinking about possibility and necessity, basically, and what's fitting. So they say, okay, so just consider the kinds of things that we know exist. All of them, anything you can sort of tabulate in terms of existence that we're aware of, there could be a creature which was incorporeal, And if there were, that creature would be as much like God as it's possible to be, at least with respect to that kind of existence among creatures, because God is not in his proper nature is incorporeal. And so if it's possible that there'd be such a creature, it would be fitting for God to make one. And we have a candidate, what seems like a pretty good candidate in the angels, right? We don't know. Do they have bodies or not? You know? So let's say they don't have bodies effectively. And you know, there are suggestive indications, I guess I would say in scripture, which seem to indicate, you know, in Luke 24, when Jesus appears to the disciples, you know, after the resurrection and they're terrified, they thought they had seen a spirit, you know, it's often translated ghost, but it's just pneuma, you know, in Greek. And Jesus says, see my hands, you know, give me a piece of fish to eat. You know, don't you know that a spirit does not have flesh and bones? I don't think that definitively rules out spiritual bodies, but it's suggestive, you know, and it's suggestive to someone like Aquinas or Bonaventure that what we should be looking for is a mode of existence that is properly bodiless, incorporeal, you know? And so then the question is, how do you understand that? Do you understand that as a kind of layered composition of being and existence and then form and matter? Or do you have this sort of more parsimonious approach that Aquinas adopts, where you try to understand it just in terms of being and existence? It just seems, it's just too parsimonious. It just doesn't have enough explanatory power, you know?
On the Thomistic conception, if you do just, there's a distinction between essence and existence, you get all these weird conclusions that what, every single angel is its own species?
Yeah, it has to be, right, because the way that, you know, as we said before, when we were talking about, say, dogs or whatever, you know, the way that tokens of a given type are differentiated for Aquinas and for Bonaventure is by matter, you know? And so, like, the difference between one dog and another is not dog nature, you know, because that's by definition what they share. It has to be something else. Matter is what supplies the difference. And so, yeah, if angels are only, if they're subsisting form, then there's no way to individuate angels within a given nature. So yeah, it's, the interesting thing is Aquinas is actually, it's a rare instance of nominalism on his part. He's a nominalist about angels. There is no such thing as an angel, actually. An angel is a kind of heuristic category that we conceive for grouping together these radically distinct, generically distinct beings. But there is no such thing as an angel nature that they all share, which Bonaventure does raise among many objections as an obvious objection to this way of thinking, that, you know, of the very limited data we have to go on, you know, from scripture and just unaided reflection about what angels are, one of the kind of central points is that they're angels. You know, I mean, there seems to be some reason for grouping them together in this under this one genre, you know? I don't think this is necessarily, it's not a defeater necessarily for his view, but it is an odd consequence. Yeah. Which you can tell he's uncomfortable with too, frankly. I mean, it's a weird thing to have to say, but it's a clear entailment though. Yeah. Of the view.
I'm wondering, when it comes to this topic of thinking about angels, does it really have what's the relevance for just the average Christian to think about angels and to wonder how that they are properly constituted? Is this more of an academic and a more of a broad, just sweeping, having the right categories about things? Or does this have direct relevance on just how I read the Bible or those types of things?
I do think that the, something that thought about the angels in general, and this is not specific to universal hylomorphism, but, you know, one of the things that reflection on the angels illustrates is the beauty of theology's uselessness, you know. And I think I'm a huge advocate for useless things. I mean, I think we need to be, and it's, you know, we live in a kind of a technocratic age, I guess you'd say, you know, a utilitarian age. It's too often unremarked how important it is that people have useless things in their lives. I mean, to take a simpler example, lower to the ground, I suppose, you know, the families, marriage is a very useful thing, but it's most useful when people think of it as useless. It's most useful when like it's a very useful thing in terms of providing a kind of social safety net, you know, to have a spouse and to have someone who's there for you. And, you know, people live longer if they're married, but people who get the most benefits from being married are people who just love their spouses, you know, who aren't in it to get something out, you know, who just think that they're, and so that's, you know, it's most useful when it's when it's viewed as useless. And lots of things in life are like that. I think friendships like that too, you know, and you know, what theology represents in its sort of purest form is it's the best kind of life. You know, Aquinas has this wonderful comment early in one of the early chapters of the Summa Contra Gentiles that he's talking about theology as a discipline, what theology is. And he says to be able to look into the very highest things with however weak and paltry a gaze is most delightful. Eucundissimum est is what he says in Latin. And, you know, I think that's something that, you know, I take very seriously as a theologian, you know, that theology, I do want, you know, of course, I hope that, you know, the work I do will be useful in some way, you know, in edifying other believers or you know, helping or potentially converting, you know, the unbelievers or whatever. I mean, who knows what'll happen with a book you put out there in the world. But ultimately, you know, I mean, I do think that the reason I'm so passionate about theology is that the most important and most beautiful object of for thought is the Lord, you know, and the Lord's creatures. And angelology brings that to the surface in a really striking way, because it's just not about us, you know. There's nothing in it for us really in the angels. And it's, yeah, anyway, I think that this is we don't consider enough, I think, the importance of having, as I said, useless things in our lives, you know, things which serve no other end, you know. And so I think, you know, there's a sense in which, you know, if you realize, once you realize that actually the best thing in life, really, at least for people who are equipped for it, you know, and this is not everybody, is contemplating the Lord and his creatures, you know, it sort of relativizes all of the other concerns here. But maybe there is some like deeper usefulness to angelology that I'll uncover later. But I think even if it's useless, that's still pretty, it's still actually pretty important precisely for its uselessness, you know? So.
Okay. So I want to remind our listeners again, number one, Brendan, you're on Twitter. So you mentioned it, you can go find him there. Second, follow the work over at the Harvard Center for Human Flourishing. So go check out that stuff there. Brendan shares stuff from it on Twitter, and I go and look at it, and I think it's super interesting, really encouraging work that's going on there. And third is, we did an episode previously on the accountable animal with him. You can go check that out. You can go check out his book on it, as well as, do you have any pending resources that you have that you want to talk about and share and say, hey, be on the lookout for this?
Yeah, good question. I mean, I'm just about to start publishing something, I guess, roughly monthly with an online journal called the Church Life Journal. So I've written for them a number of times before, but you can look, I guess, for my columns or whatever. And the reason for the incarnation in the thought of another 13th century theologian named Robert Grossetest. Grossetest, I guess. I mean, it's however you say his name. And don't say his name out loud as often as you'd think. Not that many Grossetist people running around, you know. So anyway, he's an early defender and a really interesting defender of the position that the incarnation was not contingent on sin, that the incarnation would have happened even without sin, and develops a number of really important arguments for this view, which have kind of gotten left out of the debate for contingent reasons. Basically, SCOTUS took over the debate in a weird way, like after the, you know, from the 14th century on, and so people sort of have just ignored Grossetest's contributions more or less. And that'll be in the next book, I think, which I hope will be done this year sometime, but I don't know exactly when that'll be. From Lexham Press, it's under contract with Lexham Press. So yeah, But otherwise, yeah, just stay tuned for that. But otherwise, I'm just writing occasional things, you know, here and there.
Yeah, well, that's great. So I really enjoyed the conversation. I think this was fun, especially I liked your point about the uselessness of it. So I think that was actually really nice. And so everybody's been listening. We really thank you for tuning in to the only analytic Baptist and confessional podcast on the planet. And we'll talk to you guys soon.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.